This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Ray Williams has been in the music business for more than 50 years. Grew up in England in the 1960s when British pop music had conquered the world. As a teenager, Ray soaked up the hits that day and eventually landed a job working for the popular music TV show Ready, Steady, Go. From there, Ray quickly rose in the ranks of the music industry, became press agent for artists like Sonny and Cher, The Kinks, and Cream. And then he took a role as head of A&R for Liberty Records. So it was his job to find new musicians, and Ray was determined to discover the next star. One day comes across this piano player and singer named Reginald Dwight, who you probably know as Elton John. Ray noticed Elton John's raw talent, paired him with lyricist Bernie Taupin together, and Ray soon became, in fact, Elton John's personal manager. Over the years, Ray also worked as music supervisor for dozens of films. In that job, he picks music for movies and secures the proper licensing. His work as a music supervisor led him to start a company, Crumbs Music Media. Ray helps new musicians license their songs for TV and film, and he does that from Chapel Hill, where he lives now. Ray Williams lives in Chapel Hill and joins me now on The State of Things. Hello, Ray. Good to talk with you.
Hi, how are you, Frank?
I'm doing well. So talk about those heady days, the days of the mods and rockers in Great Britain there in the 1960s.
I was a mod.
You were.
I was a mod.
So you were, you were ahead
and,
of your time.
And I was very fortunate to get on Ready, Steady, Go, which... I did because they wanted a band called Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, who I'd been following. So they came down to the a gig, and I met this lady called Kathy McGann who presented it. And so she said, "Right, I want this band on the show, and would you like to come along?" I said, "Sure." So I went along. They did the show, and then she said, "Would you like to come back next week?" Anyway, I ended up being her odd assistant. And through her, I managed to, she said, I want to get you a proper job. And she said, "I'm going to introduce you to Brian Somerville. He's looking for an assistant." So I became Brian Somerville's assistant. Brian had been the Beatles publicity manager. And he just set up this new situation. And he had three artists. He had the Kinks, Sonny and Cher, and Tommy Rowe. And so I became attached to all those three people, and it all started from there.
Ready, Steady, Go, kind of the American Bandstand of Great Britain, right?
That it really was. Right? It was fantastic.
And you were, you say, associated with this band that they wanted to have on. I mean, you were not a musician yourself.
No, I just followed them at the age of 13, 14, and 15, and they were my local band. And then they eventually signed with Brian Epstein, and they had some hits, One Way Love, and Got to Get You Into My Mind, the Beatles track. And in fact, Cliff and I are still friends to this day. Amazing.
Well, what was it that you were doing? I mean, here you are, a guy who knows a little bit about a band and follows them a lot. Now you got this TV show, wants to get them on. What do you think they, why were they talking with you about that?
And
what,
they weren't talking to me. I just happened to be hanging out with them when Kathy McGowan came down to check the band out.
How did that lead to you? What do you think that they saw was going on that led her to say, "Hey, you know, I could find you a job"?
Well, first of all, the show had young kids on there. I suppose I was a chirpy-looking young kid and also a fan of this band. So she thought I might just fit in. But she, and that's where, actually, she used to use me for magazines like Mods Monthly. So I was on the front of Mods Monthly and in Carnaby Street down in
You were a model and youth consultant.
Oh, my God.
To Ready, to just give you an idea, I want you to hear this. This is the show, Ready, Steady, Go. We're talking about in the early 60s, early to mid-60s in Great Britain.
We asked the star of our show with so many hits, we just didn't know what to start with, so we decided on Satisfaction. And here is the great, the one and only Mr. Otis Redding.
Little sense of Ready, Steady, Go, where Ray Williams was an assistant, the resident youth.
I was a resident youth.
The consultant to the show.
I get taken out to Brighton and looking, I was looking trendy with my Madras jacket.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And my
guaranteed
groovy haircut.
Guaranteed to bleed, right?
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. And my button-down shirt.
So you're given it, and were you consulting them? Or did you find that they were asking you, you know, what are the young folk thinking?
Well, it's just there was a few of us that were on it every week, for a period of time, but she would always ask me. I mean, they were meant to be hip. They were meant to know what's going on.
Right.
So it was the youth that were dictating what was going on at that time, and of course, it was a crazy time, the 60s, and there were no rules. So we ended up going around, you know, in these odd places looking for other people, other talent, and it was fantastic. But it really took off when I worked for Brian.
What were you looking for at that point? I mean, because there were some rules. There were certainly, it turns out, we find out, and there's some fairly important commercial rules about selling those Madras shirts and Carnaby Street and the fashions. Once everybody caught on to what was happening, there was some sense of good, you know, what a commercial success was, right?
Right.
Were you looking for that, or what were you bringing? You were a young man at the time. What were you listening for?
Well, before I became a sort of an A&R man, I was just interested in, you know, who influenced the Beatles? Who influenced Cliff Bennett? Because they all used to appear in Hamburg. And, of course, there were a lot of American forces over there and in Great Britain. They would play at American forces events.
Yeah.
And they would be exposed to a lot of fantastic American music. And so they started to play. And that's why the Beatles helped Mary Wells and people like this. And Cliff Bennett would be singing stuff by Doris Troy and Jackie DeShannon. And so I got interested in that, all of that stuff that was coming from America and being performed by British bands. And then, of course, the whole pop thing developed with the Beatles leading the charge. From about 63, 64.
So what's it like to be a press agent at that point? You talk about Sonny and Cher, the Kinks, right, Cream.
Yeah.
I mean, who's leading who? You know, the press agent, are you developing? It must have been a fascinating time to try to get the word out about a movement that's just changing so fast.
Well, in those days, Brian Somerville was a pretty well-known PR man. So I just followed his instruction about whether it was going down to Melody Maker or New Musical Express or going to the Record Mirror or whatever papers were going at that time. And I would have to go and meet them at the airport and hang around with them. And then I'd go on tour with, say, Tommy Rowe. And then I would, Sonny and Cher, I'd pick them up at the airport. We went to the hotel they were meant to be staying in. And they got kicked out because Sonny was wearing his furry jacket, bobcat jacket, I think. And so there's a story straight away. So we get the Evening Standard, and suddenly Sonny and Cher have arrived in Great Britain, being kicked out of a hotel. And then, you know, with the Kinks, I was sent the day that You Really Got Me became number one, and we went down in this old Austin Princess limousine thinking this was the biggest thing in the world, which it was, I suppose, in those days, and doing a personal appearance down at the Streatham Locarno, which is, I don't know how you compare that place. It was an ice rink.
Okay.
But it was fantastic. You know, I was very lucky to be touching these sort of people and being around them.
And of course, this is in the moment when they're sort of rising to fame. Clearly, this is something they've aspired to, and now you're there. As you say, you're going to be taking the Kinks to their performance after you learn that their record has gone, you know, is now number one. What's it like for them? I mean, I guess each band and each group was different, but in that moment when they had finally achieved this kind of success, hanging around them must have been kind of a cool thing.
It was very cool. I remember Ray Davies and I, they were doing a gig with the Beatles in Blackpool. So one of the great things was seeing the Kinks going on stage and then staying on stage after they'd played their part and watching the Beatles on the stage. And watching the audience going crazy. So there were lots of magic moments. There were no rules. We had no idea what we were doing, to be perfectly honest. It was just, if an idea came up, we would use it to add some press and publicity. And it was all about being around and just making everybody aware of this new talent.
What about now? So what happened to Sonny and Cher? He gets kicked out because he's not wearing a proper jacket.
So what happened? They're sort of stuck because they've got nowhere to stay. And so word gets around, no other hotel wants them. So Armyd Erdogan had a cousin that had an apartment in Knightsbridge. And
now, who is that?
Armyd Erdogan, Atlantic. I mean, he started ATCO. Do you remember? Right. You know, Armyd Erdogan, legend, legendary music person. And he was an incredible guy. So they were on his label at that time, Cher was. And they ended up getting to stay in this hotel in Knightsbridge. So as I had to travel around with them, I ended up lying on a sofa with them in this place. And then we did all the stuff of the day. And in fact, they invited me to come stay with them in L.A., which I did. And they wanted me to work for them. But I ended up working for Tommy Rowe in Atlanta with his manager, Bill Lowry.
So which is that was the first time you came to the United States, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
We'll talk more about that and your experiences along the way as we meet Ray Williams, press agent for bands in the 60s, eventually discovered Elton John, today lives in Chapel Hill and runs Crumbs Music Media and helps artists license their songs for TV and film. Our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Ray Williams, press agent for groups like Sonny and Cher, The Kinks, and Cream in the 1960s, eventually discovered Elton John for Liberty Records and paired him with a guy named Bernie Taupin. Today he runs Crumbs Music Media that helps artists license their songs for TV and film. So tell us about getting that job with Liberty Records.
Yeah. Somebody rang me up out of the blue. And it was a guy called Bob Reisdorf. And Bob Reisdorf had been brought in by Al Bennett to set up Liberty Records in Europe. Bob had a record label in America that Al Bennett of Liberty bought. And, of course, Al Bennett had the Chipmunks.
Oh, not know that.
Bobby V, Dal Shannon. I mean, lots of great people. Fifth Dimension, Jimmy Webb. Mm-hmm. And Blue Note, by the way. They own Blue Note.
Oh.
And so out of the blue, he had Dalton Records, which had the Fleetwoods, and Vic Danard, who's that other band? The Ventures.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
real classic. Anyway, he came over, he rang me up and said, I'd like you to join Liberty. I said, for what? He said, as an A&R man, you've been recommended by some people that you might be a really good guide for this.
How old are you today?
Oh, I'm a teenager still. I mean, I'd already lied about my age anyway because I look so young.
Yeah.
And it was just a bit embarrassing being that young doing anything. And I said, A&R man, my God. I said, but George Martin is an A&R man. Right. That's a proper A&R man. And so I always looked up to him and all the old A&R guys that were around at the time. They were musicians. I wasn't a musician at all. Anyway. So, long story short, I took the job and became the A&R guy for Liberty Records. So now we go into the office and we're introduced to the other folks, and there's only about four or five of us, and one was a sales guy, and one was a guy called Andrew Lauder, brilliant record man, and Bob Reisdorf and a couple of the ladies. And he said, right, now let's get A&R in. I said, yes, let's get A&R in. What the hell am I going to do?
So this is your part of the meeting. This is your part of the meeting, right?
I said, well, I think we should put an ad in one of the music papers. So let's choose what actually had the biggest circulation at the time, which was the New Musical Express. Even though you had Melody Maker, which was geared more to jazz and that sort of music, serious music. And so we created a quarter page ad because the budgets were low. And we put this ad in, and it roughly says Liberty is looking for talent, looking for composers, artists, the lot. Apply Ray Williams, 11 Albemarle Street, which is in the West End of London. My God, I couldn't believe it. We had hundreds of bags, because you didn't have email in those days. You had letters and envelopes and people ringing up and God knows what. Anyway, being a young, enthusiastic A&R man now, I went through every letter, the whole 10 yards.
Are we into the cassette age yet, or are you just getting reels of tape? Or
well, you're getting acetates.
Wow, yeah.
You know, all the acetates was quite valuable now for collectors. Yeah. And so we ended up signing a whole bunch of people. And there was family, and there was the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, which had a number one record called I'm the Urban Spaceman.
Oh, yes.
And then we signed Jeff Lynne's band.
Jeff Lynne,
which
wow.
is now ELO, The Idle Race, and et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
And a guy called Mike Batt. Anyway, this guy came along and said, my name's Red Stewart. I'm going to call myself Elton. I said, okay. I said, why don't you, he'd written in. I rang him back. I said, come in and meet me. Because I had seen him in a band called Bluesology at the Marquee Club. And he was obviously very talented as a musician. And so he came in, and the first thing he said was, well, I feel lost. I said, why do you feel lost? He said, because Long John Baldry won't let me sing more songs. And I want to sing, and I don't like the songs he's making or recording now. So I said, well, look, why don't you go and there's a piano there, go and sing some songs. So one of the songs he sang was Jim Reeves, He'll Have to Go. And so, but his voice sounded great, and he was a remarkable musician. I said, look, let's go make some demos. So off we go, and we went to Regent Sound in Denmark Street, which is our Tin Pan Alley.
Yeah.
And I had a budget of £15. I had £5 an hour.
Yeah.
We had to get two songs and then get it mixed. That's what we did. So I bought it back, and basically my peers didn't like it. They said, well, that's no good. I said, well, yeah, but he's really, really good, Anyway, the other part of the equation was that one of the letters I opened was from Bernie Taupin. And in that letter, I remember part of it, which said, basically, I think of myself as a poet, but I can't write music. And I'd always remembered Elton had said, I can't write lyrics. And a little bell went off in my head. I said, well, look, come down and see me when you're in London. And meanwhile, I want you to send your lyrics to this guy. And that was Elton. And then that's when it started to mature. And my company just didn't see it. But I, on the side, kept the thing moving along. And there were two other writers I was trying to help. And I introduced them to them. It was Kirk Duncan and Nicky James. And in turn, we decided we were going to start a little publishing company called Naraki. Nicky, Ray, and Kirk, inspired by the Hollies Gralto company, which is Graham, Alan, and Tony.
Mm-hmm.
And they were associated with Dick James. And so we did this little deal. And that's when Elton was doing his demos then over at Dick James. And then eventually Dick signed up all the agreements. And then Elton came to me and asked me if I'd be his manager. And then that's...
Put out his first records?
Dick James.
Oh, okay.
So DJM label.
So I'm going to take you
although
back.
He'd sung on lots of other people's records.
Right.
He did a lot of sessions.
I'm wondering first of all, this is on the strength of a letter that you call him back, right? You got bags and bags of mail. You don't even have a demo from this guy. You've got a letter, although I guess you had heard him.
Well, I'd recognized the...
You knew who he was.
Okay, because he talked about the band,
right.
And I'd seen them, and I thought he was good.
But it is unique at this time, and it seems to me that Elton John and his style, that's not what was happening so much. I mean, we certainly had Leon Russell, and there were individuals like that. I mean, it's not like there weren't, solo singers running around, but it's... was somewhat unique, the idea that you'd pick this sound out of that milieu, which was not at all that sound, but more of a group thing going on. What was it you heard?
Well, it's just, it was his voice. He certainly didn't look like a rock and roll star, for sure. But it was just his voice, his piano playing. He just had some sheer talent and, serendipity. I
But talk about him. Talk about him and Bernie together when they first met. How did that go? Did they click right away, or did they take
time? Clicked. As that they were both when they were very young. They were two very nice chaps, and probably are still very nice chaps. I mean, I still speak to Bernie, and but obviously Elton's career has taken just it's gone to levels really that are just enormous, and obviously will change the personality of somebody. It's impossible not to. But when you go back, they were just very, very nice, polite, lovely, lovely guys.
What I mean, you know, we all know the sound, but let's refresh our palates, our oral palates, and listen to a little Elton John.
No, it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down in the world how wonderful life is while you're in the world.
It's a clip of your song, Elton John, lyrics by Bernie Taupin, brought together by Ray Williams, my guest today, a guy who lives in Chapel Hill today, but he brought Elton and Bernie together while he was at Liberty Records, then became Elton John's personal manager. Was there much discussion about sort of what that sound would be and how to develop a sound that is clearly his own?
Well, when he was involved with the group of people at Dick James, there were some incredible people there that all contributed. Mm-hmm. There was a guy called Steve Brown who worked for Dick, and you know, was a musician and gave him some input. But also, you had a brilliant young guy called Caleb Key, arguably one of the best guitarists in the world, and had a band at the time called Hookfoot. But he also was the engineer in the Dick James studio. And he was always giving Elton more time than he should have had. And Dick got peed off by it actually. And anyway, it's another story. But Caleb actually ended up staying with Elton, played on all his records up to 1977. Mm. And then he joined Hall & Oates up to about 1981. And he's very, very important guy. In fact, he's making a documentary at the moment called Louder Than Rock.
Now, see, that's an interesting point, though. You say Dick James getting a little bit annoyed at the amount of time it's taken, but he's turning out hits at this point, right?
This is the development. This was during that period. Uh-huh. You were asking how he got to it. And what happened at that stage, there were many. Elton was acutely aware of all the stuff that was happening. He had a remarkable memory. He followed all types of music. He was absolute. So he had lots of influences musically, but pulled together by people like the likes of Caleb Kay and some of these other musicians that were around at the time. Suddenly, they made it the album, which, you know, Skyline Pigeon, Empty Sky. And then the real album, that started to get some airplay, but the real album that happened was the Elton John album. And of course, you had the influence of Paul Buckmaster, incredible arranger of the day. And you had Gus Dudgeon, who was a wonderful, wonderful producer as well as a guy. And so it just came together. But the thing about that album was that there were many sorts of influences in there, and marketing people were trying to pigeonhole it, and you couldn't. You know, it was like, well, it sounds like Jose Feliciano. You know, it sounds like this, it sounds like that. So what? It just sounded, it was a great album, and it proved itself.
And it must mean that Elton John was open to that kind of thing, so that when these other influences, producers and guitarists and other musicians, were saying, hey, let's push it this way, push it that way, apparently he was open to those things.
He was open to it if he respected the person that was involved there. And Caleb and Gus and, you know, Paul Buckmaster
So he had his, and he has his own ear. In other words, he can hear it too. And
sure,
it's not
absolutely.
Just
he's a brilliant, musician.
Yeah. So here's a song we can talk a little bit about. This is a song called "Amarina," which I think many of us know. But let's listen.
Lately, I've been thinking how much I miss my lady. Amarina's in a cornfield, riding in the debris, living like a lusty flower, running through the grass for hours, rolling to the hay, oh, like a puppy child.
Amarina, Elton John, lyrics by Bernie Taupin. I'm talking to Ray Williams, personal manager for Elton John during the beginning years for Elton John's career, and there's a story behind that song.
Yeah, that's by beautiful oldest daughter, Amarina. Bernie was now onto the Tumbleweed Connection album as far as writing lyrics, and they came to me one day and said, they came to our house in Islington at the time, and they said, look, we've got this idea for a song, and your wife is pregnant. Now, if you have a girl, would you call her Amarina? And I said, well, what a lovely name. I said, absolutely. They said, but it's spelt differently than you would Amarina, I-N-A. I said, well, how's it spelled? A-M-O-R-E-E-N-A. I said, cool. Now, if we have a boy, we can't call it that, but we'll definitely call it Amarina. And anyway, we had a little girl, and she was called Amarina. And so she's now.
Why do you think the same happened to me? I had the opportunity to name my firstborn Helter Skelter. My wife didn't. She just wouldn't go for it, which is it kind of broke my heart. Why do you think he was interested in what, I mean, was he just curious, like, would anybody name their daughter? What was it?
He just thought it was Bernie thought it was a lovely name for a girl.
Yeah.
And I agree with him, Amarina. So she became Amarina and still is. And, got two beautiful grandsons.
Came to the U.S., toured with them, performed at a club at the Troubadour in L.A., big club. And, in fact, you were hanging out after there because they were there for about a week or so, right?
Yeah, we were there slightly longer than that, but it was a week at the Troubadour, which was the most sensational thing that could happen. And we would, it was just amazing because the first night it was introduced by Neil Diamond and Leon Russell was there and everybody was there. It was a great event.
When you go to the lengths that they've gone, you talk about the arrangements, you can hear all of the other instruments and the sophisticated arrangements around his song. So it must be something to mount a show for Elton John, not to mention his own particular brand of showmanship.
Well, the thing was that he had those great records, but there was only really two musicians at that time, Dee Murray and Nigel Olsen, the drummer and bass player. But they were able to make a massive sound with those three pieces. And he became a showman. I always remember at the Roundhouse in London when he accidentally knocked a chair over. And it got a reaction from the audience. They thought he did it deliberately. But that was the whole thing that started it. So by the time we got to the Troubadour, it was all part of the act of wearing a bit of weird stuff. And I remember he used to love wearing Mr. Freedom, which was the designer of the day, all of his stuff. So when we went to Disneyland and he bought the Mickey Mouse ears, that was another thing that became.
But you're saying this wasn't always true for him, or how did this stuff evolve? Because it would seem like, especially that showmanship was something that was always his. But you're saying that evolved.
It just started to evolve from the live shows when they started to do the live shows in England. He was a really good rock pianist, so he would get in and could easily go into Jerry Lee Lewis, amazing, and. So it evolved. And then, of course, he he reacted. He was a shy man originally, probably still is in many ways, mm-hmm. but his flamboyance came out and he realized that people reacted to that. And I mean, that picture of him as a duck in LA is mm-hmm. just magnificent.
Yeah. I am talking today to Ray Williams, who discovered Elton John, connected him with lyricist Bernie Taupin, and has many other connections in the music industry. Today runs Crumbs Music Media that helps artists license their songs for TV and film. We'll talk more about that as our conversation continues on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Ray Williams, who discovered Elton John, connected him with Bernie Taupin, has been connected with the music industry for around 50 years now. Today runs Crumbs Music Media that helps artists license their songs for TV and film. He did some of that work as well, and we'll get to that part of your career. Before we leave the kind of heady days of rock and roll, as somebody who worked with Cream, the Kinks, and others, you know, people like Eric Clapton, I'm wondering how the discussions, what kind of discussions they were having behind the scenes that you may have been privy to over this, what we thought was a tension between sort of the straight line, the kind of the blues rock, and then the commercial success that they enjoyed. And I would think particularly with groups like that, somebody like Eric Clapton, devoted to the blues, is a popular success. Were there tensions? Did they have arguments about a song going this way, or no, we're not going to be that band, and that sort of thing?
I think in the case of Cream, all three came from a similar background. They had the same interests. So there was never really, in the early days, big issues. There obviously were at the end because they all split up. But in the early days, I just remember at the recording sessions, there would always be sort of debate about a bridge, you know, because that was a commercial element of something. In blues, things are just natural.
It was a turnaround, right?
So this was actually a part of maybe conforming and trying to find something that would work commercially. So it's very interesting. I mean, because they were great blues players, and you go and see them live, and it was fantastic. But when you came to the confinements of a 3-minute track, and of course, one of the great tracks is Toad. The drum solo by Ginger, which Ginger is much longer than 3 minutes. I've seen 40-minute versions of it. but in the Kinks, though, however, differently, Ray Davies was such a brilliant songwriter, and he tailored everything for commercial success. And he wrote in that way. I mean, everything was quite well structured, and it was very melodic. It had great structure in everything he did, and to this day, he's a brilliant showman himself.
And then you talked about developing Jeff Lynne too, ELO, and of course he went on to other great projects. I mean, here's a guy, it seems to me, whose real talent is also in producing. I mean, a guy who's got an ear for the whole record. And I wonder if you saw those differences too. Somebody like an Eric Clapton, who's a brilliant musician, but may or may not have heard the whole record, versus a Jeff Lynne, who I think, from my sense, is a guy who can put the whole thing together.
So when I first met him, I think he was 18, with the Idle Race. But he was an introvert in many ways. And the other members of the band built the character in the Idle Race. But when it came to making the demos for the records, he would make them at home in the old days with the old just little tape recorders. Yeah, they sounded masterpieces. They sounded like masterpieces. And he always had that ability to be putting things together. And he used to do it for the move. And one of the things that changed his life, I think, was when we came to renew his agreement, that he always wanted a Mellotron. And a Mellotron cost about £1,000. And I remember we gave him an advance for £1,000 so he could go and buy a Mellotron. And I remember he took the check to the bank and he put it in and he asked the cashier, could he have £1,000? And she brought it up on the table. He said, I haven't seen £1,000 before. And he counted it and then gave it back. and put it in the bank, and he went off and bought a Mellotron. So from the point of Mellotron, it gave him many more options for making demos, and that's why it was just brilliant. So listen to the early Jeff Lynne and the Idle Rays just before it became the Move, before he went to the Move and then ELO, you will see where he gets all this stuff from. You'll hear the Mellotron, you'll hear, but it has much more arrangement, and it allowed him to develop his arranging abilities.
Interesting. And he's already hearing this kind of stuff. Well, eventually you move on from A&R, then managing artists, to be a music supervisor in the film industry. What is that job?
Well, again, I started doing it before it became very trendy.
Yeah.
So I started in around about 84. There was in 83, there's a great chum of mine who's no longer with us, sadly, Tony Stratton Smith, who had a label called Charisma Records. And he had Genesis and Peter Gabriel and Julian Lennon. And we decided, and it also he had a lot to do with putting money in the Monty Python films. So he had an interest in films. And I had an interest that I wanted to do something more than just music, and I thought music and films was going to be a great way of promoting music and a great way for a film to get recognition from the music. So anyway, in 1984, we formed a company called the Pollyanna Music and Film Company. And it was named after another daughter of mine, Polly. I have three, another one called Chloe. And the idea of that was that we would go to films and could we take care of their music department? And we started it, and we got some really good films. And sadly, Tony died, so we had to start. I had to start again. But one of the first films that I did after that was what was it? It was Insignificance, I think it was, which was. Who was in it? Teresa Russell.
But when you talk about you're doing the films, what is it that you're doing? Are you going to find that you're
so
going
to
say,
my job, what I found to do, I always found there wasn't enough money in the budget to do what the director wanted to do. So I would talk to a director and ask him what he was hoping for the music part of the film. Right. I would have read the script. I would have noted places that maybe we could introduce some commercial music or not, because sometimes too much music is too much, and it has to be there to help it, not to take over in many cases. So I would then go to the producer and say, look, this budget you've got is not enough. So we've had to find a solution to bring everything together. And so I would hire the composer to do the score, and then I would go out and try and get the other components, if appropriate, of getting the records and getting the clearances and doing that and putting together, making the record deal, which would help promote the film, you know, the whole circle. And I found it very, I did about 70 of these things. And the biggest problem always was the issue with who owned what, because you needed to get a master clearance and you used to get a publishing clearance. So if I wanted a David Bowie track, you know, for a Lars von Trier film, actually called Breaking the Waves, it would take 8-9 months, because you had three record companies involved with it globally, three publishers, and then there was David Bowie and his manager. Actually, David Bowie was not a problem, because if he liked the art, he was fine with it. His manager was great, but it was the record companies and publishing companies that took a long time, and that's what inspired me one day to put together a site where people could go and get rights cleared very, very swiftly.
Well, I want to talk more about what you're doing in a moment that helps that. But I mean, you know, you think about the complexity of this. On the one hand, the director might want to take soundtracks that are already out there, you know, pieces of music that are going to evoke whatever emotion. So that's the hard part, right? Now this record's been made. There are mechanical rights. There's the thing you're going to play it off of. And then there are all the creative rights. And as you say, 8 months. But then there's maybe fine. Maybe they may want original music, in which case you're going to have to hire somebody. And maybe, you know, you go out and look for a guy like John Williams. Well, everybody knows what he can do. But what about emerging artists, people you don't know? And so all of that can be part of your job, right?
Finding absolutely. So even composers. I mean, I remember I used Hans Zimmer a lot. when he was working with Stanley Myers in the UK. So worked with him very early on. And
just to let you know, Hans Zimmer, of course, an Oscar-winning composer. These days he's scored Lion King, Gladiator, and many others,
yeah.
Right?
And Mr. Alexandre Desplat is another one who also has won quite a few awards. And so I would always try and get new talent and try and help them, bring them along. And of course, the director wanted a famous name, but they couldn't afford a famous name. Mm. So that's why my love for new and emerging talent has always been there.
You
and
say,
still is.
How about if you make a great movie and we'll take this nobody and we'll make them famous? You know? And it'll only cost you half. Well, David Byrne was already famous from Talking Heads, but you got him to work on The Last Emperor, the main title theme. Let's listen. Title theme from the 1987 film The Last Emperor. My guest is Ray Williams, the composer David Byrne from the Talking Heads, and of course you brought him on board. Talk about how that project came together.
So I actually worked on that film for about 3.5 years from its inception. And it was obviously made in China, in the Forbidden City. And early on, they wanted Morricone, who's a brilliant writer, but we thought that it might be an idea to get something a little more contemporary. Well, if you think back in the late 80s, it was, you know, people like Mark Knopfler were contemporary. And of course, my hero, George Martin, was also wanting to do films. So I put forward the idea of George Martin and Knopfler. Sakamoto was in the film, a great musician, but there are other reasons why we didn't consider him, which I'll come to in a minute. So we ended up with Bertolucci coming back with his 4.5-hour version of The Last Emperor. Because in America you don't have films that last 4.5 hours, it had to be cut down. Well, so we go to the screening and George Martin turns up. Unfortunately, Knopfler didn't turn up. Immediately, I was told that we're not going to use Knopfler and we're not going to use George Martin. Yeah. Of course, it killed me because I love George. Mm. So then we had to put our heads together. So Gemma Dempsey and I came up with some ideas and we put in Talking Heads. We put all sorts of things. And Bernardo just turned down the lot. He didn't know who Talking Heads was, basically. And eventually, we had a meeting, Bertolucci, Jeremy Thomas, and myself. And we said, look, we've got to get something together. We know we've got Kong Su, who wrote all the local Chinese music. We've got a great composer in the camp, Sakamoto. Well, this is a Chinese film, but you can't have a Japanese writing the whole score. Mm. But there is a Japanese element, so why don't we have him as part of the team? And that's when we managed, Bertolucci finally clicked with David Byrne. And so we thought, well, let's give that an eye, you know, let's try and pull that together. And in short, we got everybody to work together, yeah, but separately.
Yeah.
Actually,
there's a lot of cultural distance between those musics, and they all, yep, had to come together to sound right to also a popular audience, which would be mostly Western European.
That's right.
And American.
But we had to take care of the fact the film was also partly financed in China by the facilities, and some of their actors, a lot of their actors were in it.
So talk about what you're doing now, Crumbs Music Media. What are you doing?
Well, we've got Crumbs has got the licensing site of pre-cleared rights, and we're also participating in a new venture called the Nova Music Lab. And the Nova Music Lab is really four companies in the area, It's Crumbs. It's Bunker Sound, the local studio. It's a wonderful guy called John Carlson of Blue Yonder. Mm-hmm. And then we've got Scott Bradford. And Scott Bradford is a lawyer in the area from California that has lived here for a long time. And so we formed the Nova Music Lab. And the whole concept of that is if we find some incredible talent, well-deserving talent, we will help them. We're like an incubator. And so the first artist we've signed is a guy called James Holt from Bolton in England, mm-hmm. who has a lot of the abilities of a Jeff Lynne. That we recognize as studied music and is a brilliant songwriter. So we're going to bring him over to this area in November to record 5 or 6 tracks. And we're going to try and get his numbers up and develop him so that the major labels can get interested mm-hmm. or we'll look at it as then. So the idea is to help young and emerging talent. There is so much talent in this area. It's phenomenal. And so, we want to get it pathways for this talent to get out to lots of places. I mean, you've got great people here like Emerge and Yep Rock, right. You know, great people.
Now, that was the theory behind Apple Records, and you know what happened there.
I mean,
they did pretty well, but the theory was, you know, what's different? What's different today, and what do you bring to that? The idea that there's great talent out there, we just got to give them a break, and we're in a position to do it.
Yeah, but I remember the Apple days. I actually tried to... in fact, there was a guy introduced to the company called Ron Cass. He was working at Liberty, and we introduced him to Apple. The problem was Apple had the Beatles.
I remember.
They had the Beatles running it. Yeah. So therefore, they had James Taylor, of course.
Yeah.
And I just think it was too complicated, too many politics involved with the label itself.
Well, this sounds like a great idea. And, of course, Crumbs allows young artists to put their stuff up there.
Yes.
And then you clear all the rights and you got it. So you just figure out which you pull down from the menu and figure out.
Well, they can send stuff up and we A&R it.
Yeah.
And it's all done online.
Yeah.
And if we can reject it or we can approve it and we prove it, the contract goes back. They can sign it. Once it come back signed, I can put it in the catalog.
And then a filmmaker might come
and a filmmaker may come and buy their stuff.
Very cool stuff. Ray Williams, what a pleasure.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Ray Williams is the founder and CEO of Crumbs Music Media, started out in the music industry on a show called Ready, Sit, Steady, Go. And, of course, was press agent for Sonny and Cher, the Kinks. You heard the whole thing. And you can hear it again at our website, stateofthings.org. The program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Norman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.